This may sound stupid, but did I read your, was it you that wrote something about rules lawyers in your book just recently?
Yes.
Okay, that's what I was reading.
Yeah,
I
Delegating the Rules
knew I
Lawyer.
was, yeah, I was, I knew I was reading something rules lawyery today, and it made me think of in the last game, I had James, who's always rules lawyering everything.
Right.
Like he's the one that I go, oh, that was the context. You said appoint somebody the rules lawyer. He's
Right,
the one.
right,
Except he pulled that shit on me.
right. Well, that's right.
Well,
That's the hard part, right?
that's the great part, though, is that Mike includes in it that you have the ultimate power of veto.
Yes, check this veto out, right? Okay, so they're fighting Knowles in this room, and I said, okay, he runs to the door, opens it up, and runs through. And James goes, wait a minute, opening a door is a move action.
Right.
And I went, wait, what? He goes, yes, opening a door is a move action. I said, let me see in the book. So he shows me in the book. I said, okay. So he runs to the door. That only uses 10 feet of his movement. And James says, well, he'd need a feat to take a move action in the middle of a move action. I said, all right. I think that's stupid, so I'm gonna take it to a vote. How many people at the table think I should ignore that rule and let him move through the door? And like one person raised their hand. I said, okay, how many people think I need to follow the rule and he needs to take a move action to open the door and that will end his turn? And everybody else raised their hand. I said, all right. He runs toward the door and it opens for him. Fuck you guys.
From the Rule Zero Studios in High Barsoom, this is Rule Zero, the podcast for gamers to talk about gaming. All games, all gaming, all the time. Welcome to the conversation.
We have a very special Heart of the Matter in this episode. For you, we have our first interview, and allow me to introduce Mike Shea of Sly Flourish.
Hello.
Hello, Mike. This is such a very special Heart of the Matter that we've gotten rid of the news and our own gaming experience stuff.
Yeah, there's no news.
There is really no news.
There is no news more important than the release of a new work of literature.
Yes.
Oh.
Classic. Can I say a new classic?
I think you should.
I think it's a new classic. I'd be willing to go there. I'd put it up there with probably Ethan Frome.
Oh, yeah.
So Mike has just put out The Lazy Dungeon Master. Mm-hmm. Is this under your Sly Flourish imprint, or is this under a different release system?
No, it's pretty much the same. The other two were always kind of like Sly Flourish's whatever.
Right.
This one isn't Sly Flourish's whatever, because Sly Flourish's The Lazy Dungeon Master sounds weird.
Oh, okay. Okay.
It's just The Lazy Dungeon Master.
Gotcha.
Well, tell us a little bit about yourself and about Sly Flourish.
So I'm like a middle manager in Northern Virginia, and I've been playing D&D a long time, since I was like 14. Started with second edition and
nice.
Played second edition for a while, got off of that, played a lot of Magic the Gathering, and then when I came to DC, got started in a 3.5 game with Chris and
nice.
My girlfriend at the time and now wife, and my girlfriend's ex-boyfriend, Joseph, who's now a good friend of ours. And we played a lot of 3.5, and then we got started in 4E, and I kind of got in the ground floor of 4E when it first came out. I was very excited about it, and I didn't get too tied up in Edition Wars, and played a lot of 4th Edition.
Edition Wars is so 2008.
Well, and I think you can really look at people and look at personality types when it comes to Edition Wars. It's the same people that hated every expansion that ever came out for an MMO.
Oh, yeah.
Right.
I was like, I can't wait for the next expansion. Everyone else says, I hate expansions. So it's kind of the same. I'm always like the new, whatever the new thing is, I'm happy to go to the new thing. It's
Why just, wouldn't sure. you want to play with the new toys, you know? Well, even if they break after the first try.
People like the old, they don't like a lot, but we could talk about that for hours. So with 4E, and then I looked at it, and I listened to a really interesting podcast from a blogger that I like named Merlin Mann, who did the site 43 Folders, and he did some other stuff, and now he's kind of a kook and does other things. But he did a podcast with another guy I really like named John Gruber, who runs Daring Fireball, a very heavy Mac-focused website. Both of them are solo guys that run their own businesses from that kind of thing, and they talked about how to be a successful blogger, and they had some really interesting advice that seemed kind of counterintuitive, like really narrow your focus down. So don't be the Star Wars guy, and don't be the guy that talks about Jawas. Be the guy that talks about that one Jawa in that one scene who says this thing, and that way on the internet you're the go-to guy for that Jawa. Like anybody ever has a question about that Jawa, you're the guy they're going to talk to.
There you go.
And
so did that Jawa really say, I love you,
exactly.
Because it sounded like
that. Yeah. He didn't really say that. But besides, I'm the Tusken Raider guy.
Yeah.
That one Tusken Raider goes...
So I said, well, you know, so I want to make a role-playing game website, but I'm going to narrow it by saying it's really about Dungeons & Dragons, and I'm going to narrow it further by saying it's about 4th edition Dungeons & Dragons, and I'm going to narrow it further by saying it's for Dungeon Masters. So I'm not going to talk about player crap. I'm not going to talk about other versions. I'm not going to give... I don't do product reviews. I don't. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of, like, things I don't do on the site, and mm-hmm. instead it's, here's DM advice for people running 4E. And that became a good niche. I mean, there was not a lot of people that talked about it, but it was a pretty popular area.
Yeah, I recall hearing a lot of podcasts at the time were very player-focused, like, play this kind of class and take this thing.
Yeah, and my feeling was like...
Radio Free Hamlet was, like, right. the ultimate power gaming 4th edition podcast.
Sure, right, right. Yeah, there were actually there were a lot of podcasts and a lot of websites that talked about 4E, which... Mm-hmm. to be pretty self-focused. Like, they talked a lot about how they felt about the game or what was going on in their game. And, mm-hmm. you know, I tend not to find that particularly interesting and useful. I think we all have interesting games. And, you know, putting that on the net isn't necessarily the best service in the world.
Agreed, right.
But, you know, unless you're, you know, Gabe and Tycho. If you're Gabe and Tycho, I really want to hear about your game. Or Chris Perkins, you know. Even him. Like, Chris Perkins, I'll skip his thing where he talks about his game. Yeah, like I don't know if you read his articles on DDI.
You're hardcore, man.
Yeah, well,
seriously.
I don't, you know, I want to hear what his advice is. I want to hear, like, you know, tips from Chris Perkins, but I'm sure he's got an interesting story. We all have interesting stories.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So, and we, you know, we're absorbing interesting stories all over the place. So, I don't know. So, I didn't want to do that on my site because that wasn't something I really cared about. And so I did that. Then I read a really interesting book called 37 Signals, which was about web design and web building web businesses, and I loved the book, and I said, I want to write a book like this, but for D&D. So that's when I did DM Tips. And then I had finished an Epic Tier game. I ran through you know, the 21 to 30 game for you, and not a lot of people had. And I'd learned a whole lot about where it breaks down and what you need to do when it breaks down. And I said, you know, I could get even more niche, and I could write a book just about running Epic Tier D&D games. So I wrote Running Epic Tier D&D Games. And yeah, good fitting title. Although I'll tell you that was like the biggest mouthful of a title, and I couldn't figure out any way to make it any shorter.
Right.
Mm-hmm. You know, Sly Flourish is running Epic Tier D&D games, because I'm like, if I cut any one of those words, something's not right.
You should have cut it down to Sly Flourish is awesome.
Awesome. Yeah. Yeah. And then people are like, this isn't awesome. This sucks.
Well, my money,
but right. contrary, Epic Tier games are awesome.
Yeah. Right. But if I didn't have tier in there, then running Epic games could be something completely different.
That's true.
Right.
Anyway, that was a labor of love. It was short, and you know, they sold it for $4, and you know, it's certainly paid for its cost, and I think it paid for my writing. But it didn't fly off the shelves because not a lot of people are playing Epic Tier D&D games. But that said, no one else has a book like that out, so I was happy to have that out.
There you go. That's
cool. And I'm trying to remember exactly where. I think if I had to point at a moment where the whole lazy dungeon master concept came, it was like a couple of years ago, and I was listening to Robert Schwab. Do you know Robert Schwab?
I know who he is.
I know who he is. Yeah.
So like the most recent book of Vile Darkness. He's a fantastic guy. He's a freelancer for WotC. He's one of the you know, like kind of like Monty Cook was. He's a contract freelancer for WotC.
Right.
And everybody was up on a panel, and they were talking about their game, and somebody said, like, how long do you spend preparing for your game? And he said, I spend as little as possible. And he goes, and if you don't include, like, thinking about it in the shower time, probably about 5 minutes. And I was like,
wow.
I spend like 8 hours prepping for a 4-hour game. You know, like,
yeah, that's what I was doing too. I was doing like 2 hours for every game hour.
Right. And I'm like, how can anybody do 5 minutes? What the hell is that? And so like, I kind of didn't really do anything with it at the time, but I sat back on it and thought about that and continued to run my very heavy set piece 4E games. And I think 4E really leans towards that. Like it really wants a nice big set, you know, it has these big set piece battles. The encounter is really like the core brick of the of 4E games, and everything else kind of fills in the gaps between the bricks. And so it certainly lends itself to a lot of prep. But then I started playing D&D Next playtests earlier this year, back in February. And while I was doing the playtests, you know, I was trying out, like, well, how do you do encounters without maps? And how do you do, you know, how do you make things a lot more dynamic? You know, Caves of Chaos was the first adventure that came out, which is the first part of Keep of the Borderlands. And it's a very sandboxy adventure where there's all these different caves and all these different monsters in these caves. And listening to all the people that were running that adventure at DDXP back in February, it was pretty wild to hear how different all of their stories were. Where some people were like, you know, they got killed by the kobolds in the kobold trap. Another group had the kobolds on their side and was attacking the, you know, hobgoblins on the opposite side. And so everybody, nice. And one was handling a, you know, breaking up a marriage. So all kinds of crazy stuff was going on. And I thought, like, that's so wild that all this stuff is going on. And the thing that seemed to make that possible was that nobody was really planning it all out ahead of time. They didn't have these big set pieces, and they weren't sure where the battles were going to take place, and they didn't know any of that stuff. And, you know, so that kind of led back to that original thing that Schwab talked about, and I was like, well, not only can you spend less time on prep, but when you spend less time, the game ends up being a lot more dynamic. And so I kind of refined on that and refined on that and refined on that, and the next thing I knew, I had this book.
Oh, okay.
So that's about me and the book. That was a very long.
Well, that covered the next question. I was going to say, tell us about the Lazy Dungeon.
Well, back 14 years ago,
the Lazy Dungeon Master 4.
That's a good question. that's a real good one. And one of the things, I tried to tune my books around different groups. You know, I don't expect, like, I'm going to write a book that's, you know, everybody should read this. It's fantastic, because I expect that. You know, if you're a new Dungeon Master, you should read the Dungeon Master Guide, right? You should read the material that you need to read to get the core understanding of the game, and then other supplementary things can kind of help out. So
I just look at the tables. I figure the rest is easy.
Well, and there's some people who do, right? There's a lot where it's just go ahead and start playing, and you'll figure it out. I mean, everybody has stories about when they're kids where they didn't know that there was a D20, and all they had was a D12, and they rolled, and they had fun anyway.
Right.
So, you know, who cares? That said, I want to make sure that the books are aiming for the right people. So, like, my first book, DM Tips, it expects that you've run some games, right? That you've already tried this stuff out a little bit, and that you know enough to know the basic rules, but now you're starting to look at some other stuff that the book doesn't necessarily tell you. Because the book wants to, you know, the book being the Dungeon Master Guide, you know, the Dungeon Master's Guide has to be written for every Dungeon Master. You know, it has to be open and loose enough that all different styles of DMing can fit within it, and all different experience levels will get something out of it. And that's a really hard thing to write for.
It's daunting, to say the
least. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So it's a lot easier when you say, I'm going to write for just this specific thing, and I'm going to write for this specific group. So I would say that the Lazy Dungeon Master, so just to hit all three books, the first book is meant that you've run a few games, you know, either, I would say, between a dozen and hundreds of games, and hopefully you'll get something valuable out of if you play dozens to hundreds. Epictier is expecting that you've run a lot of 4E games. You know, like, you're not going to be running a lot of the ideas in this book, because this whole book is about breaking rules that you should already know. And this kind of gets into, like, Stephen King on writing. You know, you can go ahead, like Stephen King, and end a chapter in the middle of a sentence, and then skip to a whole new, you know, frame of reference in the next chapter when you're Stephen King.
Right.
Right. Right. If you're not Stephen King, don't stop a sentence in the middle. you know, don't end a chapter in the middle of a sentence. The same is true with this. You have to break all kinds of rules to run a decent epic tier game. And if you don't have experience knowing what those rules are there in the first place, if you don't know what the difference is between ongoing 20 damage and ongoing 60 damage with epic tier guys, you're not going to want to just jump right into this book. The Lazy Dungeon Master has a bit of a wider audience. First of all, it's not focused on 4E, and some people have pretty accurately stated that it's not even really that focused on D&D. Right. I certainly aimed it towards D&D because that's what I play, and that's kind of
right.
The audience.
So that must have been in your mind while writing.
Yeah, absolutely.
I feel that it is focused towards D&D and Pathfinder, though, because a lot of times that's... You mentioned other storytelling games currently out, like Fiasco, in the book.
Yes, right.
And I've been more or less heavily involved in those for the last 8 years. But I've constantly run into, I'm not going to say necessarily conflict, but a lack of interest by people who have been longtime D&D players, right. Because of the shared storytelling elements.
Because they're not generally there in D&D?
Because I don't think anybody practices them there.
Right, right.
Or have practiced them as often as they could. I mean, for the most part, it's always been the DM tends to be more of the conductor.
Right. Yeah, and that's certainly, I mean, I think a rules-heavy game is going to have more of that kind of approach.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, I mean, it's interesting that, you know, looking at a game like Dungeon World or 13th Age, I don't know if you guys have taken a hard look at either of those, but
mm-hmm.
Yeah, so I mean, Dungeon World and 13th Age both have kind of group storytelling built into their systems.
Yes.
You know, as does Fiasco, right? But Fiasco is so far different from D&D that it's hard to even bring the two together as in anything other than how to bring tips from one into the other.
Right.
But yeah, certainly those games, which have kind of a root in D&D, have approaches where they're bringing in some group storytelling kind of ideas as part of character creation, which I think is really cool.
Right.
And yeah, so the idea is, like, how do you bring more of that into a D&D game? And that was certainly a focus for the Lazy Dungeon Master. So it's focused for Dungeons & Dragons players, but it could really hit all editions. I mean, one thing, I talked to Chris about this early on when I was just started writing it, because I don't know anything about Pathfinder. I know 3.5, mm-hmm. but it's been so long since I played 3.5 that I'm not even sure how the techniques work. And my big question for Chris was, like, does reskinning work in Pathfinder? You know, I mean, or is it, you know, because monsters and creatures are not designed the same way that in Pathfinder that they are in 4E.
Right.
Does reskinning work?
I reskin all the time.
And yeah, that's what you told me. Right? That you reskin all the time.
I did too when I retconned to some of the modules.
Yeah, right. So that's great. You know, that means that it generally works.
Mm-hmm.
And so I wanted to make sure. I mean, certainly the book is going to have a focus on probably more on 4E and D&D Max than any of the other editions, just because I don't play those editions, or I don't play them nearly as much. Mm-hmm. But I like to think that a lot of those tips are useful for all editions of D&D. And you know, this was something that I needed to be careful of because of when I was writing it and when I was publishing it. We're between editions right now. And,
right.
you know, there's not any, as far as I can tell, there's no new 4E product coming out other than digital products. And D&D Next looks like it's a ways off, like maybe a year, maybe
really?
More. Yeah, huh. it's a way off. So I wanted to make sure that what I write now isn't going to be immediately obsolete when Next comes out,
right.
and that it doesn't necessarily focus on a game that isn't getting nearly as much support as it used to. So that's one of the reasons why I kind of designed it to say I'm going to write this more system neutral than other stuff. But I think it's important to still have a clear focus, and D&D was that focus.
Mm-hmm. I applied the principles to Pathfinder, and it wasn't like I needed to adapt or convert any numbers or anything
right.
like that. It was
right.
it was concepts, and the whole book is full of concepts as I read
right.
it.
Right, right, right. And then as far as experience level, I think it probably takes a good bit of experience to really understand this. I don't know that somebody brand new. I mean, it's quite possible that somebody brand new is only ever going to do stuff this way, and it's going to be fine for 20 years. I expect it's going to go the other direction, that people are going to start with heavy planning and then start to strip more and more of the planning away.
I kind of want to give a copy of this book to my son before he starts taking over the storytelling side of the games, just because
mm-hmm.
I want him. This is the sort of practice I want him to be in
right.
before he starts to do stuff, because I know he's an idea kid. He'll just start popping off ideas in rapid fire.
Right, right.
But I want him to also realize that part of the joy of it is the sharing the story, not just holding onto the story.
Right, right. Yes, I mean, even in my little marketing, you know, my marketing blurbs here, I say that, you know, the expectation is you've run dozens, if not hundreds, of games, right? And the intent is that the concepts are going to be kind of advanced enough, not necessarily in, like, that they're complicated, because the whole point is simplicity. That the confidence is such the big part, right? This is the thing we were talking about earlier with the three things, that the three things are really not actually helping you plan the game. The three things are there to make you feel good. So
yeah.
when All you're right. sitting down at the table, you're confident, you know, it's like you have,
and
the right
I tell you a lot of the prep time that I call prep time that I'm spent preparing for my game. A lot of it is just sort of going over the same things over and over again, yeah. dreading
right.
doing it wrong.
Right. I mean, and so
that's yeah. actually a strong part of the focus of my prep
yeah.
time is dread.
Yeah. Right.
Interesting.
And so here,
because I've got to tell you that for the most part, since I hit my 20s and second edition came out, I've had a level of confidence that I can run this without fear of screwing up. Mm-hmm. One of the things you mentioned, though, in the book, while you were going through this stuff, how you have to kind of unlearn everything you've learned if you've run 12 to 100 games. How difficult was it for you personally to kind of break out of the mold?
Well, I don't know that I fully have yet. And you know, one of the weird things when we talk about kind of the emotional states of it is I can actually point to an exact time and an exact place, and it's me walking out of my office building at like 5 o'clock on Wednesday night, where I'm going to have the same panic attack every week. Ooh. And it's, you know, about an hour before I'm going to run a game, I got to go home, I got to walk the dog, I got to make sure everything's ready. And when I started doing this stuff, I would immediately get a panic attack of like, oh my God, I'm not prepared. Right. Like, right. I haven't done anything and everyone's going to come over and they're all going to laugh at me. Right. And
why would they flip and laugh at you?
Right. Well, yeah.
Are these not also your friends as well?
Well, that's the thing, right? Of course, they don't care. They're just coming over to drink beer and, you know, have some bad food and laugh and
Mike,
joke.
If they laugh at you, they're not good.
Well,
gamers.
Yeah.
Pretty much.
If they laugh at me, I will.
Unless
set
you say
fire.
Something funny and you want them to laugh, then that's okay.
I will
okay.
stand there covered in blood and set fire to the whole place and close all the doors and burn them all alive.
Awesome. That's what I say.
Just like in Carrie. Nobody got the Carrie reference?
I got there.
Okay, just making sure we're all on the same page. So
I'm all over that. I was going to say something about how we keep coming back to Stephen King. But
yeah, I love Stephen.
Oh, that was
guess. Yeah, right. Guess who one of my idols is. So what the hell are we talking about? Unlearning some of this stuff.
Right.
Mm-hmm. A lot of times when I wrote, so you know, I can't thank my wife enough for going on these long dog walks with me where I talked all this through. And a big part of it was like, is this all just bullshit? Like, is this just, I'm writing this stuff like it's true, but is it really not? And no one can do this. You know, like this is crap and people are going to try this and it's going to suck and their games are going to suck and I don't even do it. Like you know, I'm writing a book and I don't do it. So, you know,
we'll edit that part out.
You don't have to worry about that, Mike. Because honestly, one of the things that I encountered, and like you and I in our talk discussed this, that there were times when I'm reading through your book and I'm going, Jesus, get out of my head.
Yeah. Right.
But my biggest problem was I was in the midst of running a campaign when I was first introduced to concepts of. You know, taking it down a notch rather than amping it up a notch in preparation. Mm-hmm. And a lot of it came from an early Burning Wheel game and an early Dogs in the Vineyard game that my friend Judd ran. And I walked away from that gaming weekend just gobsmacked. And I sat down and I talked to him and he showed me links to the Forge and a bunch of other forums that I could go to and really start to rethink what was going on. And it's just really hard. My biggest thing was you don't realize what a control freak you are.
Yeah.
Until you try to actually take it down a notch in an long established system like D&D.
Right.
And it took me about 2 or 3 years to finally really start to let go.
Right. Yeah, I mean, mm-hmm. I think...
And that was my homebrew campaign was the first time where I really let the players drive.
Yeah, yeah. I think that one of the criticisms I have yet heard but expect to hear about this is that I kind of tuned the book the wrong way because dungeon masters are generally far from lazy and they don't want to be lazy. Like they love spending their time on this. And that was actually when you talked earlier about it not being preachy. It took a fair bit of work to get it to that point because it kind of got it, you know, I was worried it would be preachy. I think my other books can be a little preachy and certainly the writing on the website can be a little bit preachy. And one of the things I wanted to be clear about is that, you know, we're not saying you don't have to prepare or that you shouldn't prepare or that you can't prepare when you want to. It's about doing it, thinking about what you're doing and thinking about the economy of what you're doing. Is this really going to have a high value or is there better places you can spend your time, you know? And I try to outline a few places where you can spend your time, like NPC generation, you know, good NPC stuff I think is important. And building a toolkit. Chris, you talked about having your card with a bunch of random names on it. You know,
right. That's indispensable.
Right.
Oh, completely. Completely for all of us, I think.
I think, yeah, right. I have a little laminated piece of paper with a bunch of names on it. And I think it's when you prepare your toolkit to be to support improvisation, I think it can be really great. Have you guys seen the Pathfinder face cards?
No.
So these,
I think they come with each adventure, or not come with, but they're available for each adventure pack.
I think so. Yeah.
Which has like the NPC heads, right?
Yeah. So they have some generic ones too. They have a couple of generic packs, and then they have the ones that are built for the adventure lines. And they're about $10, and they have about 52 cards, and all they have is a face, a drawn NPC, and nothing on the back, no name, no background, nothing. Which I think kind of torqued some people off. Because they wanted an NPC, but like I don't, you know, I'm happy not having an NPC because I make all my NPCs up out of characters from Breaking Bad, so I don't need any.
Have you given up on Deadwood?
Well, no, I still go back. Everything always ends up as Deadwood in my campaign. I
have put Deadwood in like three campaigns.
Yeah, right. I just introduced a new character from Deadwood in my campaign. But these face cards are great, and they're another like ad lib tool, right? Or you know, an improvisation tool because I'm not gonna. At the table, I could just, they're talking about NPCs, and they're like, oh, I talked to the guy at the bar, and you kind of flip through the cards, and you find one, and you're like, hey, it's this guy, and his name is, and you pull a random name off, and then you think of a guy from Sons of Anarchy, and you're like, hey, he's, you know, this guy, right? So Bobby Elvis from Sons of Anarchy becomes your core, you know, bar guy. And you know, so it's like preparing those tools so that at the game, the story can evolve is a really good area to prepare instead of preparing stuff, you know, that you expect to run a certain way at the table. And I think that's a hard idea to get, but once we re-steer our actions down a path like that, I think that the results can be pretty rewarding. And my experience has been that that's the case. And I think, one of the other things I really wanted to do, because I was worried that this is just more of, you know, Mike Shea's bullshit, and who wants to really hear that, is what, are we swearing? Are we allowed to swear?
Are you swearing?
I'm swearing.
We break the tag all the time, or at least
excellent.
I do.
Okay.
We're allowed the S word. We're not allowed the F word.
Oh, bummer. Okay. So, you know, I really wanted to make sure that I was backing up my backing up the bullshit that I was saying, that I was going to either interviews or podcasts or real play examples. So I have, you know, a huge amount of references in this book, way more than any of the other books, to articles written by professional dungeon masters. You know, there's, how many of those are there in the world? I know of one, and that's Chris Perkins. And even still, I'll bet you the dungeon mastering part is still a secondary job. In fact, I know it is. But so there's a lot of stuff that he has done, or Ed Greenwood. You know, you can't really go too far wrong quoting Ed Greenwood and how he runs his Forgotten Realms game, because, you know, what are you going to tell him he's wrong? So I wanted to make sure that I was,
you know, actually, Ed, that's not,
yeah,
true.
Ed, I, you know, you're following the canon.
We actually ran a Burning Wheel campaign set in the Forgotten Realms.
Cool.
And Ed found out about it and gave us some very positive feedback. I thought it was really rather wonderful.
Yeah.
Because Burning Wheel is a fantasy, you know, thing based heavily in Tolkien type stuff, and running it, it seemed to fit so organically, beautifully into that system.
Yeah, I mean, and that was the thing that kind of reinforced that this isn't just some weird crap that I picked up that nobody actually does follow or will follow. Mm-hmm. Is that a lot of people are doing it this way. I mean, you said you were doing it this way, and that's great. Like, I wasn't. You know, I was spending hours setting up my stuff. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and I still wonder if, you know, I still look back and go, well, am I losing stuff by not spending those hours? So I haven't set up a Dwarven Forge array in, you know, a few months. And it's hard to go back because it's so, you know, I love that stuff, but it's a pain, and it's worse if they don't go there.
But that's a different kind of, I mean, you can still have those sessions where you've prepared the layout. You know, like if they've gone in the dungeon door and you know they're going through a section,
but
you know, you can still lay that out.
I can, but I haven't. Like, you know, like even in the last game, I had them going, and I knew where they were going.
It's just it's part of. I think we're all somewhat secretly frustrated fantasy writers.
Yes,
right.
You know, and that's one of the reasons we put so much prep into a game is because we had an adventure in mind, we had an end goal in mind, and we were like, and I was like, okay, I haven't fleshed out the characters and the dialect, so I need you idiots to come in and do that for me. Mm-hmm. And when we're done, then you can go home, and I can write my story.
right. The game would be great if it weren't for the players.
Yeah, exactly.
So, yeah, right.
Well, I've played in campaigns that were basically somebody else's fantasy story, and we were kind of just like drawn from encounter to encounter that we couldn't avoid.
Yeah, yeah. So. And what's interesting is how much, and I think we're worried about it. Like, I think we're really honestly worried about what's going to happen if I don't have this. And one of the other tricks, and I don't know if I really talk about it in the book, but here's a little secret trick for you guys, and you probably do this already.
Bonus tip.
Exclusive. This is a Rule Zero
exclusive. Yeah, baby.
Do you have some music?
All right, hit us with it.
If you force yourself to go into a situation where you have no choice but to improvise, it's pretty freeing. So I would always, you know, like one of my big things when I was dealing with 4E, it was like, how can you have a sandbox game and still plan out your encounters and stuff? Like, it doesn't make any sense, right? Because if they're going to, you know, and so I would say, well, you always make sure that they choose at the end of the session so that before they leave the table, you say, okay, you have three paths. You can go here to your new airship, or you can go here into this evil dungeon. You can go back to town and deal with the weird intrigue that's going on there. Which are you going to do? And you have to say one of those now. And they say, oh, we're going to go to the town and deal with the intrigue. And you're like, okay, now I know what we're going to do next week. Yeah. And so I'm now doing the opposite, where I'll end the game and I'll say, and now your options are these. I'll see you guys next week.
Well, that's brassy.
I'm at that situation right now where they just finished a major event. They killed a lizard king that had been enslaving dudes and blah, blah,
they
blah.
They killed Jim Morrison?
Yeah, right. So, they killed Jim Morrison, and I'm like, and they have all these options available. Well, really two big ones, but then a bunch of small ones. And I don't know what they're going to pick, and I'm not even going to ask until the game. And at the game, we'll say, and now where are you guys going? And then I have to figure it out. Right? I don't know. Mm-hmm. There isn't a way for me to plan it.
So are you doing it that way deliberately? Yes. To make yourself use these tips?
Yeah. I'm doing it deliberately so I can't, I have to, I'm doing it specifically so I don't have a choice. But
fantastic. But you see, that's I think is kind of, I think that what you've kind of hit with the Lazy Dungeon Master is kind of what I consider to be the height of the craft.
I don't know.
Is the fact that if you throw yourself into that, if you throw yourself into the deep end, it shows that you find you have all the tools.
Yeah, and that's the hope.
You really do.
I mean, 4 years from now, I might look back and, whoa, what a bunch of crap that was. You know, you really need to spend time preparing.
Well, did you get any of these ideas from other games? Were there other games that influenced the way you approached the Lazy Dungeon Master? Anything that that made you say, you know, I don't really have to have this thing, you know, shored up all the way?
Well, so I rarely play any other games, but Fiasco certainly had a big influence on it from the group storytelling and you know, Chris, you've played in games where I've used the Fiasco style relationships, and those always seem to be a big hit.
That's funny. The first time you pulled it out, I went, "Oh, somebody's been playing."
Yeah, that's exactly right. You knew exactly what it was as soon as I said it. And and if you read the first part of the Dungeon Master Guide 2, the 4E version, they talk a lot about group storytelling. The idea that your players can tap way more into the story than just their characters, and mm-hmm. that's interesting. That's actually a thing that kind of puts players in kind of this scary position, which you don't always necessarily want to do. Sometimes they just want to be the character. But I threw them in a really uncomfortable spot a couple weeks ago, where
like the back of a Volkswagen.
Yeah, right. Yeah, nice. So I let them hear a conversation that their characters didn't hear.
Oh, okay.
And, you know, it was something like these nice people that they liked sent them off to this cave, and then after they left, they say, "Hey, you didn't tell them about Death Mist, did you?" And they go, "No. If they manage to survive Death Mist, then we know that they're the right ones."
Nice,
you know. Nice. And the players are like,
so they kind of got like a cutscene.
Yeah, and I love kind of have, and I emailed them another one, and some players hate it. They're like, "Why? You know, what am I supposed to do now?" Like, I, you know. Oh, you know, like, how can I not, you know, they can't dissect it. And I said, look, if I thought that metagaming it was going to be a problem, I wouldn't have told you.
Exactly.
So you can go ahead and metagame it. I'm not going to worry. But on the other hand, it's kind of this interesting thing that you see that isn't something your character sees. And that starts to kind of stretch them outside of the boundaries of their character sheet and start to get them to think more about the overall world. And there's lots of little things you can do, like, hey, what's the name of your sword and where did it come from? You know, that magic sword picked up. And
some of the best questions you can always ask is just about their folks.
Yeah, but you can't be the McLaughlin group, right? And they go, oh, right. So what's the name of your word, your sword? Oh, it came 4,000 years ago. Wrong, you know. Mm-hmm. There weren't swords 4,000 years ago, you know. And so you have to go with whatever they come up with,
which is fine, you know, because you can pretty much incorporate anything, even if they go ludicrous on you,
right? And you can particularly, you know, you can particularly incorporate anything when you don't have anything.
Exactly.
Right. If you have this giant detailed game world with 100,000-year history, and they say, I got it 4,000 years ago from elves, and you say, sorry, the elves only crash-landed here on their crazy spaceship 2,000 years ago, so it couldn't have been from there. Well, then they're like, oh, I'm sorry, I'm stupid in your BS fantasy world. You know,
then you give them minus 500 XP
right,
and tell them to
read
the wiki.
Guys, right. You should have read Obsidian Portal, you jerk. So, right. So, that's the thing.
Is like I did a big wiki for my last for my homebrew campaign, and like there was one player who was interested
yeah,
in it.
Yeah. Okay.
And she made lovely comments. I thought they were right. Wonderful.
Well, okay, two players.
I got to tell you that it's funny because one of the players during the time that I started to transition over to this more we'll call it lackadaisical dungeon mastering technique, one of my characters had said ahead of time that he just had a collection of junk, mm-hmm. stuff that had no purpose whatsoever. He had a map, a treasure map, that wasn't located on the world in which we were currently playing. He had a charm bracelet with lead little caricatures on it, and he had a spider in a jar. And because he gave me these little toys, I would throw in instances where he could actually use those.
Right.
Uh-huh.
Right.
And it was wonderful to see, especially the look of surprise on his face, because at one point he's visiting a family whose job it is to make golems. And they're like, well, we have to be very careful in this during this part of the process, because if we, you know, if anything, any impurity enters into our mix, the golem will be ruined. Hmm. And he's been hired by a rival family to screw up the golems. So he's like, huh, you know what? I have a bracelet with lead things in it. It was just, I mean, it made for some very fun storytelling on both of our parts.
Right. Right. Yeah. And that's where you get into like both Dungeon World and 13th Age and mm-hmm. how they have a lot of these kind of character traits wired in that end up telling the story. Mm-hmm. You know, I think that, yeah, there's lots of times where you can do that. And it's not easy. Like I think we're always kind of pulled into the idea that we have ideas in our head and leaving them unfinished is really hard to do. Because we like, I, you know, not to plug other crap, but, you know, I just wrote an article on Sly Flourish about leaving things unfinished and this idea that you don't always have to end every story you start, that sometimes leaving them with loose threads, interesting things will happen. And I'm struggling with that right now. You know, my NPC, one of the players started up this whole chain of events, and I've got this chain of events going on in my head that's actually a continent away, right? So they have no idea what's going on. The PCs are, you know, I'll be surprised if the PCs actually see the results of it.
Okay.
But, you know, I can really go through the details, or I can just kind of let it roll in my head, and we'll see where it goes. And most people don't like that. They like to write it all down. And kind of plan it out and set up some kind of crazy, you know, network.
Actually, not writing stuff down kind of jibes with my style because I'm really good at coming up with ideas. I'm not so good at writing them down.
Yeah, well, okay. You know, not to plug in Stephen King again, but Stephen King said that not writing them down is not so bad because if they're really good, they'll come back.
No, it's true. I find that to be true also.
Yeah, I find that. I got yelled at like crazy when I put that on Twitter. Yeah. I had people I really respect that are like, you are such an asshole. So yeah, who said I was an asshole for not for telling them not to write stuff down?
So, screw them, man.
Yeah, they really were. They're like, this is the worst of advice I've ever heard. I'm like, hey, man, relax. You know, and I'm like, and wow. I don't follow it. I carry a notebook and a pen everywhere I go, and I write everything down. So
I do too. Actually,
you know, that's one of those like. You know,
I actually carry a sometimes stack it's of worth 3x5 cards.
Yeah, yeah, actually, yeah, right. Getting things done stuff.
Well, I have a notepad app on my phone. That's what I carry around.
Mm-hmm. Oh God, you're just so technologically
high-tech, yeah.
Snappish.
I bet I can write my stuff down faster.
Hey, Mike was just talking about Twittering everything. So
that's okay. Yeah. He's allowed to. He's really? The guest. I'm allowed to zing you.
What other questions do you have?
Oh, we've got lots of questions.
But we have so few answers.
We'll see.
What was the hardest thing to let go?
What was the hardest thing to let go? Probably building out the encounters. And this is a 4E, particularly a thing with 4E, because 4E's encounters really, they ask for a lot of variables. And, you know, I looked at my checklist in DM Tips. I have a checklist for all the things for a 4E game that you ought to have planned ahead, and particularly there's an encounter checklist, which has like 12 things on it.
Wow.
And it makes for really great detailed encounters where you have all of these different little elements to it. But boy, it takes a lot of planning ahead of time. And I still, because I've been writing, I've been playing almost all D&D Next since writing this book. I'll be interested to see how well it translates back to 4E because of that. Like, can you, I know people can run 4E stuff this way. And I know that if you have the right tools on hand, you can build decent encounters. It probably requires a fair bit of experience, but you can do it. And, that, you know, that's something that can be pretty tricky. That's hard to let go. And then I'd say, like, you know, not, you know, filling out the whole story, you know, with having a beginning, middle, and end, knowing where the players are going to be going, and saying, like, okay, you're heading from the beginning of the dungeon to the end of the dungeon, instead of just saying, well, I don't care, you know.
Right.
All that stuff.
That was the hardest part that I found, too, was you know, sitting there and going, oh, I had a goal in mind, but you guys aren't going there.
Yeah, right. Like, okay.
Crap. Right. But, yeah.
Yeah, wait till they skip the whole dungeon, man.
Oh, yeah, been there.
Sure. Where they fly over it, right? Like, you have this whole big thing and they fly up and zip past it.
Yes, exactly.
You know, I try to account for different ways to approach a dungeon. I didn't try to account for them just skipping it altogether.
Well, and that's...
let's not go in there. We could get hurt.
Yeah.
There's dangerous stuff. Right.
No, I got nothing.
We have reason to believe there's monsters inside. Yeah.
And that's one where I
let's go tell the authorities.
Yeah, I certainly think if you're prepared to recognize that you're going to have to come up with something, it's a lot better than if you prepared something and they bypass it, and now you have no idea where to go. That puts you in a worse spot than if you walk in knowing that you have no idea which way they're going to go. So that's part of it as well. I think somebody can end up being in a stronger position when they're prepared to ad lib than they are. You know, than they are if they try to plan everything out and it all goes south. Mm-hmm.
So. I have a question for you real quick. I think that Chris has run into this, and I've run into this before. And I'm not sure how a lazy DM would deal with it, per se. I'd have to bounce it off again, have somebody try it on me. But when your players go to a more powerful NPC and go, hey, could you deal with this?
Yeah, and the NPC's like, well, that's why I hired you bastards, right?
Yeah,
I was about to say,
no, that's why you guys are here.
Right, right. Isn't that a common problem in all of our games, where, like, why is the most powerful NPC asking weak guys to go after the guy that just happens to be slightly, you know, equal to or better than them, when, you know, Gandalf could walk in and take care of all the goblins himself?
Right.
You know, like, why the hell is
that? One of the conceits you kind of have to
accept. Yeah, and that's just one of those, like, I'm very busy, I'm reading this old book. You know, or they're stopped. So like, look,
the way that I solved it was that it was the adventurer, the retired adventurer in question, was very, very old.
Yeah.
And they were like, could you take care of this? And he goes, well, I'll see what I can do. And he just basically expired of old age on the way over to deal with it.
I mean, one way is to have him do it, right?
Well, I had the NPC that was hiring them going off and doing her own adventure with the group of named NPCs in the town. They all went off together to go into the mountains to solve something that was their level.
Nice.
So you could have it where, like, they come back.
And I mentioned they came back with a bag full of loot, and I said at the table, because they play D&D too.
That's wonderful.
You could have it where they come back and their story is the one that all the townsfolks are talking about. They're like, oh yeah, hey, you cleared that gob. Oh wow, look, these guys killed a dragon. Man, look at all their stuff.
Oh, when they skipped my dungeon?
Is that what you did?
When they came back to the dungeon that they skipped, they saw the adventurers coming out of it with piles of loot.
Oh, that's fantastic.
Why? Because I'm passive aggressive.
Apparently.
That's fantastic.
There's a section for your next book.
Yeah.
How to avoid being passive aggressive dungeon master.
Yeah. The lazy dungeon master gets passive aggressive. Fantastic.
So how can somebody get a hold of The Lazy Dungeon Master, the book, that is?
It's available in a few different formats, but I think the best one is to buy it directly off the Sly Flourish website. So if you go to slyflourish.com, and on the right side, there's a nice picture of the cover. If you click that, you get the, you know, blurb, read the blurb, read the sample, and decide if it actually is a book you want.
Hold on, I'm going there right now to check that out.
Yep, I'll wait.
Oh,
watch your hit meter.
I like hearing
go up.
You type.
Yeah, there we go. Oh yeah, and it's a beautiful graphic.
Yep. Jimmy Bonagowski did it, She's a great artist. I found her through my friend Michael Mallon, who runs the website The Id DM. And yeah, she turned that cover around, and she'd read the previous book, so there's little Easter eggs in the cover. I won't say them all, but there's some interesting little funny bits in there. Yeah, and so right on there, you can buy the ebook package. You can buy it through PayPal, and you will get an email with the downloadable ebook package that includes two versions in PDF, a version in Mobi, and a version in EPUB. So you should be able to put it on pretty much any device. It's also available on...
I've got it on my iPad right
yeah,
here.
Yeah, yeah. So the PDF is really, you know, this version's the best version by far from a value, because you get four versions of the book. You can put it on anything. There's no DRM. You can, the PDF version is printable on 8.5x11, or you can print two pages on the 5x8.
That's just what I did, actually.
You printed it on an 8x11? Yeah.
Yeah, the 8.5x11.
Yeah, the internal design was done by Eric Nowak, who's a local D&D guy, freelancer, and graphic designer. So he did all the internal layout. One of the criticisms I got for previous books is that the PDF version was pretty pedestrian, and they were absolutely right to say so. This one I actually... outsourced the
I love your page graphic. Your page number.
Yeah, well, that's not mine. That was him. That was his idea, and I thought it was fantastic. I saw it, and I was like, oh, I love it. Yeah. So then
I won't hold the papyrus against you, though.
What's that? Yeah, the use of papyrus? Yeah.
Yeah.
Nothing wrong with papyrus. So.
Oh, my.
Font Wars.
Hey, look, it's better than Comic Sans. Yeah.
And I gotta love the fact that you mentioned Deadwood three times.
Yeah, I'm not surprised. Yeah, Deadwood's fantastic. In fact, yeah. So one of the things I tried to do is I wanted the book to be pretty useful even after you've read it. So I included lots of like 1 to 20 lists, and they're not typical 1 to 20 lists. So it says like top 1 to 20 movie inspired quests.
Oh yeah.
So that way you can.
That was cool.
Yeah. So the idea is Here's 20 movies, and if you know those movies, then you already have an entire line for a potential quest at the same time. And there's no reason you couldn't take three of them and mash them together into one big thing.
You did one of my favorite things in the world. You did a D12 list.
I have a D12 list?
Yeah, gotta use the D12.
I love the D12s.
The poor neglected
D12.
Where
do I use it? Where do I have a D12 list? I gotta get that out of there.
A list with 12 items.
Yeah, you had 12 items.
Oh, really?
Oh, yeah, no. I don't know if you've seen the website. I had a thing that was called Love of the D12, and I put up 12 different names for a greasy spoon or a pub or whatever, and whatever your campaign could be.
Awesome. I hate the D12.
I meant to follow that up, and then I got really busy this fall. So
The D12 is that die that just rolls forever. Why won't that die ever stop?
I think it's wonderful.
You ever roll a D12, and you just see it, and it just rolls and rolls and rolls and rolls right off the table?
Oh, you see, I roll in a box, so it doesn't. Yeah. It doesn't roll away.
Annoying. The D4 and the D12, my least favorite dice. So
it's the dodecahedron. That's just meant to roll.
Yeah, right. It's might as well be a circle.
No, that's
perfect
the
sphere.
Or the D30.
Yeah. So that's where they can get it. You know, it's $6. I tried to keep the price down and pretty reasonable, considering it's a digital. Started digitally.
So you're not selling a print copy.
Well, I'm actually getting the galleys for the print copy probably next week. I had one run and it didn't work out, so I'm having another run. I hate doing print copies. But it'll be available. It'll be $10 plus shipping. So it's like the collector's edition of Halo with a little cat helmet. You're not really getting. I think the book is worth $6.
Oh yeah.
I don't think it's worth 12, but if you want the hard copy and you want to pay 12, by all means, I'm not going to get in the way. but for me, I think you get a better value from the PDF, from the ebook package, just because you get all the different versions of it. So.
Absolutely.
Completely. Yeah.
So what is coming next from Sly Flourish?
I have no idea.
Good for you.
Yeah. From as far as publications go, a break is going to happen for a while.
Mm-hmm.
I'm actually writing up my experiences doing 3 ebooks. That'll probably be not a Sly Flourish thing that I'm putting out, though. That'll probably be on my own website. But if anybody cares about how to make ebooks, then this will be interesting. I've been toying with the idea of doing doing an adventure. You guys talked about published adventures,
mm-hmm.
right? On it, and I thought a lot about that. And Chris, you and I had talked about it after the podcast, and. Mm-hmm. I really want to see what I'm not ready to throw out published adventures yet, but I don't think that any of the ones that I've seen are designed the way I want them to be designed. And I've heard, you know, Perkins wrote in an article on DDI that many, it is well known to Wizards that many people download dungeon adventures and never play them. And that should come as no surprise to anybody, right? And but people use them for inspiration. And I talk about that in Lazy Dungeon Master, that, you know, an adventure is better as inspiration than it is as something that you play through.
True.
So the question is, then why the hell are we designing
it
that
way? I noticed
way?
Your comment that it's often more work, and I got to agree
with
that.
And, that's not a unique comment to me, right? Lots of people have said they can actually be. I got that from you. I mean, you said that on you said that on your podcast.
Well, no wonder I agree.
You quoted from that dungeon art or from the dragon article a million years ago, or some other article a million years ago. So that's what I dug up. You sent me a copy. And
the Lisa Stevens.
Yeah, article. Right. So. So what would in my mind, this is the question that I'm trying to figure out and trying to answer, and I don't know if I'm going to get there or not, but if you're building an adventure for inspiration, what would that look like, right? Like, what would if you're going to make a product and the product is an adventure, but you're designing it so that it helps the lazy dungeon master and it doesn't require a lot of prep and it isn't a linear thing, it's a sandbox. And some adventures have gotten real far with this. But I haven't yet really seen one that didn't require a fair level of work. Like, a lot of them have really high word counts.
Yeah.
Well, I'm just not going to read all that crap, right? I mean, even the good ones, you know, I don't read all the way through. So, you know, how do you say, like, okay, well, here's your three potential plot seeds, and here's your three main NPCs, and here's, you know, a nice map of the land, and here's a bunch of, we were talking about not finishing the story, right? So maybe we write part of an adventure. And the part of the adventure has just enough that a good DM can look at it and fill in all the blanks.
Right. Or you can make it like the Clue movie with three different
endings. There you go. Or none, right? You don't have any endings. They decide. And actually, what's interesting is in the current D&D Next playtest, they have Isle of Dread as their playtest adventure.
Yay.
And I've been running it for my home game. And Isle of Dread is, and this is why I might not end up doing this, because I think WotC's headed there and they're going to get there before I do. Isle of Dread is like a campaign. It's like a 10-level campaign in a 32-page adventure. So it's got, like, here's a whole bunch of caves over here, right? And it doesn't spell out the whole caves. You don't need to have the whole caves. But it kind of gives you the general seed of what's going on there, and it works. So one thing I thought about doing is you know, if I get a decent idea, although Deadwood's always a pretty good idea, so you wouldn't be surprised if it turned out to be Deadwood. you know, a published adventure that was designed for a, you know, designed, you know, quote unquote, right, you know, designed for a DM to be able to use easily and steal from and rip apart and, you know, throw in any game world and, you know, throw into a campaign or not throw into a campaign. And I wouldn't be surprised if lots of people said this and then tried it and it turned out not to work. So it's very likely I could do this whole thing and look at it and go, wow, I just ended up writing an adventure like the old ones were.
You know what?
Well, it's hard to. Yeah. Go ahead, sir.
Chris, please go. Please.
I was just going to say it's hard to bind up the idea of, you know, just three points of interest and three NPCs and three of this other thing, and you know, it's hard to package that up into a book and sell it.
Yeah, well, that's true.
My point being that I don't think you have to sell it as a book. It's just a 2-page thing. It's both sides of a piece of paper.
Maybe, and you know, maybe a lot of it is art, right? And the nice thing, and I think that, you know, this is not to start getting into the whole e-publishing is taking over the world kind of idea, but the nice thing is that it doesn't matter if it's 2 pages. You know, 2 pages can now be a sellable product, right? Like, it had to be 32 pages and everything. And I know that, like, traditional publishers in gaming still think of everything as breakdowns of 16 pages. Right, because that's how the leaves work. You know, that's how the press works. So everything's got to be these breakouts of 16. The digital doesn't matter. It can be anything. It can be any size. It can be, you know, you can do 3x5 note cards, and you know, you can design it however you want. So that's a nice kind of lack of restriction that we could do an 8-page adventure. I don't know if you're going to sell it, and I don't know how much you'd sell it for, but you might have a 99-cent 8-page adventure, and if it's good, decent art. You know, then it could work out. Now, you know, you might have some people that read it and go, look, I read this thing in 10 minutes. How is that useful? Right? Like, I want big adventures. You know, I just got, and I'd love to hear, Chris, I think you played the whole, what's the name of the big Pathfinder Adventure Path?
Well, I've only gone through one module in the Adventure Path far. We're just starting the second module. Well, and it's been like close to a year.
What's it called?
The Legacy of Fire.
Oh, okay. No, I'm thinking of their original one.
Are you thinking of Rise of the Rune
Lords?
Rise
of the Rune Lords. So they put out the whole Rise of the Rune Lords Adventure Path in one giant book. And I just bought it because it was cheap. And I was like, wow, you know, that's like, I don't know how many adventures, 6 adventures or something like that for $22. Yes. So that seemed like a really good package. And, you know, I mean, the question is, you know, can you produce something? I mean, that's got a lot of words in it. And, you know, can you produce something where you have these 99-cent little stripped-down adventures that are actually useful for a DM mm-hmm. rather than kind of this, oh, God, you know, I got to run this other thing.
It is a pretty onerous tome to look at.
Oh, yeah, the Rise of the Rune Lords.
And think about running out of it.
Yeah, and I might. You know, I was actually thinking of running Pathfinder as a mini-campaign and running at least that first module, which seems pretty straightforward.
Yeah, I'm a big fan of mini campaigns too. By the way, that's why I really enjoyed that section as well.
Yeah, yeah, me too. This is I don't know that I'll ever. I mean, I ran a whole 1-30 campaign that took 3.5 years, and I loved it, and I'm really glad I did it, and I don't think I'll ever do it again.
Here, here.
Because I think that nowadays I want to try other game systems, I want to try other worlds, and when you can get a taste of them, it's really nice to say like, you know, Dark Sun is a nice place to visit, but I wouldn't want to live there.
Oh, heck no.
You know, so that like running 5 levels in Dark Sun is just enough. That's like, yeah, don't go near any plants. And if you see a flower, that flower is trying to kill you.
Pretty much.
Everything is trying to kill you, and everything is made out of a dead thing.
That was everything is made out of, There are 2 rules of Dark Sun, right? Everything's made out of some other dead thing, and the world is the antagonist.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So those are great. So that, you know, I've been toying with this idea of what would an adventure look like, and I might do something with that. The other thing is probably after D&D Next comes out, I'm probably going to revise Sly Flourish's Dungeon Master Tips. Because it's very 4E focused now, and that's fine. It could probably do with a revision, and that might be hard to do because so much of it is going to end up just pointing back to the Lazy Dungeon Master and saying, you know, it's all in there.
Well, does the Lazy Dungeon Master change anything you were thinking when you wrote the other book?
Yeah.
I mean, does it change anything
a little bit? Certainly with Dungeon Master Tips. I don't think it nullifies any of it because one of the big things with Lazy Dungeon Master is this is, you know, we were talking earlier about, or I was talking because I talk a lot, about...
Well, we are interviewing you, so it's
yeah,
unexpected.
Right. That's not going to stop my wife from giving me shit later, though. So, you know, that the Dungeon Master's Guide has to be all things to all people, right? It has to be an inclusive thing.
Yeah.
And the nice thing is we don't have to be inclusive. We can be very narrow and say, here's one thing. But one thing I wanted to say with Lazy Dungeon Master is, and I think I had a whole chapter that was just this. It is one way to do it, right? It is not the way, and it is not the only way, and it doesn't negate any other good way to run a game. If people were having fun, you know, who the hell cares?
Right.
It's but you know, some ideas may work and some not, and you know, it isn't, and that was really hard because I felt so strongly about it when I was writing it. I wanted to tell people, no, throw everything away. Throw it all out the window and just use this. And I kept having to pull back and go, no, that other people will use it another way. So nothing in Lazy Dungeon Master, you know, negates the stuff that's in the other books. But it's gonna be hard for me to go back and say, you know, I had your checklist of the 3 things that you need to do. 3 things you might do as a lazy DM, and then go back and say, but here are the 12 things you might do if you don't want to be as lazy.
There you go.
You know, okay. That's going to be hard to do. So I don't know what a rewrite of that book is going to look like. And luckily I think I've got 2 years before I have to worry about it.
Well, there you go.
Do you have a prediction for the release date for Next?
I don't know anything. So I think it's safe for me to guess.
Okay.
They said, I'm trying to remember, last Gen Con earlier this year, they said that it looked like it was 2 years out, and I think they were saying 2 years out from when they announced it. So my guess it will be a year from February.
Yeah. Really?
I think we've got one whole calendar year left.
I think we both guessed Gen Con 2014.
Yeah, that was pretty much our mutual assessment.
That might be right. The few, not to get all inside baseball and business crap, but... The few things that I heard is we heard the president or the vice president of Hasbro who runs WotC. I crashed a press event where he was hanging out with some people. And he said that the way they're handling this, because the big question was, how the hell can you have a playtest where you're basically not selling any other products? And mm-hmm. how do you have a playtest for something that's going to last that long and fund it, right? No other place could do that. And he said, mm-hmm. look, Magic funds it.
Yeah, okay.
So he said, we're getting money. He goes, because that wasn't the case with 4E. 4E was supposed to be self-sustaining, and it was supposed to be the next MMO. That's my opinion. This isn't something I know. But they really designed it to be an electronic product. And with Next, they stripped the team way down. There's a lot less people working on it, as it appears. They're much heavier on freelancers. And I think that they can run for a long time before they actually have to produce a product. In the meantime, their team is still developing a lot of stuff. So there's a lot of system agnostic releases and a lot of board game releases and a lot of miniature releases that I think mm-hmm. are keeping their design team afloat on top of the fact that WotC is producing these other products. And that they're kind of regrouping.
They keep coming out with rule revisions on the D&D on the playtest.
Oh God, all the time.
So yeah. I mean, that's something that's constantly.
Yeah, and it's so weird because part of me is like, it's not coming out fast enough. I want more, and then they put it out. And I'm like, wait, too much, right? Like, I barely figured out the rules from the last.
I wasn't done with that.
Yeah. So and I'm actually, we've been pretty heavily playtesting Next, and I think we're going to take a break for, two or three months and do something else. Maybe it depends on what my group decides. I'm happy to do anything, but the options are, do we want to do Dungeon World? Do we want to do 13th Age? Do we want to do Pathfinder? Do we want to do 4E, or do we want to do Next? And which game world do we want to run in when we do that? And we'll do that for a couple months, and then we'll come back to Next once they've gotten a little further.
Cool.
So we'll see. But that's my prediction. I think the prediction of Gen Con 2014 may not be wrong. I would say it's probably either that spring or that fall. The thing to keep in mind is they have to have a 6 month production time. Mm-hmm. So you'll know when it's about 6 months out, but they'll probably announce it. But you'll certainly know by the time they say, okay, playtest is locked down. Because they're not going to keep playtesting when they're publishing the books. And it takes 6 months to publish the books.
Gotcha.
Yeah. In this day and age.
Yeah. But this is, the whole role-playing market, not to get all. First of all, I want to talk about Superman. But before we talk about Superman.
Really?
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah. Definitely.
Yeah,
you want to talk about Superman to me?
but we'll get to Superman in a minute.
Clearly,
we'll get to
Superman.
We'll get to Superman in a minute. Before we get to Superman, what are you guys Marvel? Or you guys hate Superman, right?
I hate Superman.
I like Superman.
Good.
He hates Batman. I love Batman.
Yeah. Did you guys? Okay, I guess we're talking about Superman now. Did you see the new trailer for the new Superman movie?
Yes.
Oh, I have not seen it.
You guys have to watch it right now, and you have to play the Monty Python music while you guys go watch it.
Okay.
Yeah. We'll be right back. Okay, I've seen the trailer.
There you go.
All right. Are we back?
Yes.
Not yet.
Oh.
I need a moment. Okay. No, it looks good.
So this is my, like, I would love to see a Superman movie where the last frame in the movie is him wearing the suit.
Yeah.
Like, I'm perfectly happy with a 2-hour movie about his origin. And without fighting a supervillain.
The thing is, I am up to here with origin movies.
Really? I can't have enough of them.
Yeah.
I think that
Did you ever read the All-Star Superman?
I don't think so. Oh, I'm actually in the middle of it now.
Okay. The beginning of that is probably the best origin story of Superman I've ever read.
I'm Amazon.
It's three panels long.
It's what?
It's three panels long.
Really?
Yeah. It's fantastic.
Yeah, I mean, like, is there anybody left in the world who doesn't know Superman's origin?
No. And it sounds like they're kind of, it looks like they're changing it a little bit, right? Because they kind of make his or his father, his adopted father, is scared of him, kind of, it looks like.
It's funny because that kind of harkens back to the cartoon Supermans of the 1930s.
Yeah. So All-Star Superman is worth reading?
Oh, All-Star Superman is definitely worth reading.
It's worth
$12? It's probably one of the only comic books in the last 10 years about Superman that I gave a damn about.
Did you notice in the trailer that both of his dads were Robin Hood?
Really?
Yes. Yes, I did.
And Clark has two dads. Oh, that's going to be my title for the movie.
Nice. Does he have two dads? Is that right?
Clark's dad is Robin Hood.
Yeah, but I just I don't know. I love a Superman that focuses on the idea that he's an alien and on Earth.
Right, and that's the best. All the best Superman stories kind of focus on him not really belonging here.
Right. Yes. And that, and you know, I was talking to a friend of mine about what a good Superman video game would be, and he's like, "How do you have a Superman video game when the guy's immortal?" And I said, "You make human beings his life bar, right? Like the number of dead people are the way to determine whether or not you succeeded or failed in whatever your job was, because that's his weakness, right? Is he has to protect us."
I say, screw a Superman game. You need to make a Lex Luthor game.
That'd be cool too. So okay, enough about Superman. So the other interesting thing is where we are in the RPG industry is really fantastic. And it's scarier in hell for some people, and a lot of people are dooming and glooming and, oh my god, this is the end of the world. And a lot of other people, you know, are not. So when you see like a guy like Monty Cook, and you guys talked a lot about Monty Cook and I think either one of the news segments or something like that a while back. That here's a guy who was working for WotC as a contractor and quit, and we don't know why, and it kind of doesn't matter. And then he went out on his own, and he earned he pulled up $500,000,
wow,
for his Kickstarter. Jeez, and you're like, right. I'm guessing that WotC didn't pay him $500,000, right? Or I mean, okay, so let's be fair. Let's be fair, and let's take out taxes. Let's take out, you know, the fee, and let's take out free. I'll bet he probably pulls in half of that as money that he can actually spend to use to live on to make the book. And I'm guessing.
I think that's probably a high estimate, but maybe
you think.
I don't know what kind of sales he has.
So. Yeah, I mean, and I'm still guessing they didn't pay him that.
Oh, right. No, right. Definitely not even close. Definitely not.
So then you read, like, I don't know if you guys saw the State of the Mongoose, you know, the Mongoose Publishing had a kind of a State of the Union 2012 article. Did you guys see this at all? You should put this in news here.
No.
I'm sticking in the chat so you can put in show notes.
Okay.
And they talk about what it was like, and they say, like, they're putting out products where they put a lot into it, and they only sold less than 1,000 copies.
Wow. Dang.
Yeah.
Oh, that's a recent article.
They just posted this.
I honestly didn't know there was still a Mongoose publisher.
I didn't know. They folded probably about 2 years ago.
You know, and I'm paraphrasing a quote that I should instead find. But what they said is that, you know, they in sometimes they were selling less than a few. They were selling a few hundred instead of a few thousand copies of something. And what they had heard is that for some of the things that, quote unquote, a big publisher in this industry were saying, is that they were publishing about that as many as well for some of their stuff. Right. Well, and I don't know who they were referring. They'd probably be referring to WotC or Paizo. And my guess is they were probably referring to WotC. But, you know, then you say, like, yeah, but how can that be? And then all of these Kickstarters are pulling in tons of money for two, you know, groups of two or three people. And it's not like they're getting rich, you know, it's not like, you know, people are driving around in Rolls Royces now that they made all this, you know, Monty Cook's flying around in his jet, you know, to work on it. But
Monty Cook can fly.
Yeah, he's like Superman.
He can also breathe in space.
You know, they're not, but they're finding ways to make, I don't know if they're going to scrape a living. And I seriously doubt, like, you know, it's kind of a lottery win to pull in that kind of money on this stuff. But the industry is getting turned on its head. And I think that's great. Like
I think so too. I think that's fantastic.
I mean, and this is it's really ironic when I look at it, and it's, and I'll I don't know if ironic is the right word. I don't want to get in trouble for using the word ironic.
You're not Alanis Morissette.
Say that it's poetic.
It's poetic. Oh. It's interesting that, you know, like, I could not have pitched the Lazy Dungeon Master to any of the groups and likely gotten it bought.
Right.
And if they had bought it, I don't think they'd make the money that I'm going to make on it for a very small run. You know, like, my target benchmark for, like, when I turn a profit is about 370 copies. And I should make that in about 3 or 4 months. You know, that just based on sales of Epic Tier and DM tips, that my expectation is I'll sell about as many copies, if not maybe a little bit more. And, you know, that will end up making it a better profit than if I had sold it to somebody. You know, that's beyond cost. It's already paid for its own cost. And that was not possible 5 years ago.
Right.
You know, so that's, you know, I mean, all of the, you know, I'm guessing every one of us has our own role playing game that we have on a hard drive somewhere, right?
Right.
We said this is better than anybody else's thing. This is the first time where all of us can publish those simultaneously, and the market will decide. You know what? This one's really good, and that's great.
No, I think that's fantastic too. Chris and I had a talk about this a while ago. I think probably around the time of Entities on the Outside.
Yeah. Speaking of Superman.
Yeah.
So that's my rant about the current, a I don't know, soapbox about digital publishing and PDF. You know, it's the whole thing is fantastic. I mean, the profit margins are crazy. The efficiency in design, really changes everything.
And I think that's, you know, that's helped to lead to the explosion of indie games in the last 5 years.
Yeah, right. I mean, I think a lot of folks have kind of looked at the RPG market and said, oh God, it's going down. And if you go to the FLGSs, you know, the game stores are having a really hard time, and they are, right? And they're having a hard time because the same way that GameStop is going to have a hard time in 5 years.
Oh yeah.
Or Best Buy is having a hard time now, or Circuit City had a hard time 5 years ago. You know, I mean, the world's changing.
Nobody has their own media anymore.
No, God, you know, I'm getting rid of all my DVDs.
Right.
Replacing them with Blu-ray. But, yeah.
Okay, so how can people find you, Mike?
So for the people that care about anything I write that's interesting, they should go to SlyFlourish.com. And I'm on Twitter at twitter.com/SlyFlourish. I also have my own personal website, but that's boring and nobody wants to read that.
Well, it's in my RSS.
Well, thank you. Sure, you get one article every 3 months.
You talk about work efficiency.
Yeah,
I find that useful.
Well, that's actually they're all tied together, right? All that kind of self-helpy BS ends up finding its way into these books as well. So it's nice that there's a practical, you know, a practical way to look at that. But I think I write on that site about once every 2 months. Because I'm writing a lot of other stuff. And another little plug. I think you will see a WotC release. It's going to be like a game day product kind of thing from me, maybe early next year.
Okay.
So I finished it and I turned it in, and I think it's going to be pretty cool.
Cool.
And awesome. I can't say anything more about it.
Oh, I like it already.
I do too. My appetite has been whetted.
Well, thanks for coming on the show. Thanks for being our first interview.
No problem. I'm glad I could be your first interview. I'd come back anytime. I could sit and talk about myself anytime you want.
Well, you're welcome to come on the show and talk about anything you want anytime. Awesome. So thanks a lot.
Sure. Thank you.
And that is all we had for the show today. So from me.
And from me.
And me, I guess.
Game on.
Game on.
Rule Zero Podcast is licensed under a Creative Commons Attribution License. You can use our podcast in your music video or send us to your friends and family, but be sure to mention our names on our website at www.rulezeropodcast.com. Segment and closing music is by Maggie Sansone, used by permission, and is available at maggiesmusic.com.